On the advice of my lawyer, I respectfully refuse to answer that question, as my truthful answer may tend to incriminate me.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, all you wiretappers out there. Say the same thing, exactly the same thing every time. I don't know. I hope that doesn't get too boring. I think it gives a person a certain feeling of comfort that they know they're in the right place. Anyhow, I'm here in the studio with my good friend, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Left out the part about the Ice House building. This is a cool old building. It's been made into some lofts and some other businesses here. It's kind of the new way of taking an old storage house or old building, old brick building, and rehabbing it into studios and offices and living arrangements.
The other ice houses around town, there was one down by Brush Creek. It's gone.
Is it?
I know that there's another one in Kansas City at the moment, but the American Ice Company used to be a big company before refrigeration came along.
Yeah,
it ruined it for everybody.
Really? I read somewhere once where they cut these huge blocks of ice and pack them in sawdust and put them on trains and bring them like down to Kansas City and store them in buildings like this packed in sawdust. And they'd have enough to last, you know, all summer for people because they'd use it all summer for their ice boxes.
And then they'd actually use the building as a morgue.
Yeah, they kept bodies in here, too.
Because it was cold enough that, the bodies wouldn't rot away, and they had to do something before, when they had 3 days to get them into a cemetery.
That's true.
And, of course, I do the Big Dumb Fun Show from here, which is a drive-time-style trending talk, independent, unsigned music, radio, television program, which is live on Mondays from 7 to 10 p.m. Central Standard Time. You can find us at BigDumbFunShow.com.
And then download old episodes, go back and review old episodes off your website, right?
Yeah, we've got older stuff there. Not really old, because it got kind of crazy there.
What, you have too much content?
We've been doing this since 2004. Wow. So everybody would come along and want all of our content and repurpose it and link it through to their website. So
yeah.
Right now we've got episodes up from last year at the moment, and maybe if we set up a subscription service, I'll let some of that stuff from 2014, then 13, 12, and 11, and 10. Every once in a while, you can find stuff if you look on YouTube.
Yeah.
There's old, clips from the program, including interviews with some folks that you might know from watching NBC's The Voice.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah, you had that.
Cassie Joy.
Cassie Joy, didn't you?
Follow her on Twitter at Cassie Joy Music. And she's great. Actually, I went back. I had to search through to try to find some old stuff, and I found some stuff a couple years old and some stuff that was like from 2013 and 2011, and before Big Dumb Fun Show had YouTube, somebody else had it, and we got it from them.
Yeah.
Thanks, YouTube, for that. But before that, we were putting stuff up from the Big Dumb Fun Show under Venkman, who was one of the founders and hosts of the program with myself. And there in the archives under Jeff Hurst, I think it is, or Venkman, I tweeted it out, was like 2009 with Cassie Joy.
Oh, wow.
And it was great. It was just phenomenal acoustic set. She was in a band, if you Google searched, In Like.
Yeah.
That was a band that she was in at the time, before being on The Voice. And
are you going to repost that show?
I did.
Oh,
well,
good.
I didn't repost the show, but I did repost some of those segments.
Okay, cool.
And shared that on Twitter and stuff. But no one cares about that, because what they really care about it's true crime
true
and the
crime.
Mob.
That's why everybody's here. So let's get into the mob. This is the second of a two-part episode about Joe Ramo. Joe Ramo was the first Italian police officer with the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. He was assigned down in what we call the North End or Little Italy, and today it's called Columbus Park. It's where all the Italians moved and lived and worked when they first got here in Kansas City. It started at the city market and goes from about the river, really, 3rd Street up to about 6th Street from east of Main to Grand to about 10 or 15 blocks east, almost to Troost, which is about 15 blocks east of Main. It's about 6 blocks north and south. It was a small neighborhood. It still kind of looks like, if you drive over there today, it still looks like the Lower East Side of New York City or something. It really has that big Eastern City look, doesn't it? No yards, all like 3- and 4-story apartments, look like walk-up apartments. That's where I went down there on Gillis. This lady got hold of me about the app and said that her dad, I was talking about tunnels, and her dad still lived, her grandpa still lives on Gillis, and she said there was a big vat to make wine in the basement, and there was a tunnel that went underneath Gillis Street to what used to be their in-law's house or their sister's house directly across the street. So I went over there and met her, and we went in. And Grandpa showed us around, and we went down in the basement, and there was a specially built huge vat made out of concrete that had to be for making wine. They mashed the grapes up in it and let them ferment and then bottled the wine. Then the room right next to it had some shelving in it. And she said that's where they used to store the wine after it was fermented and bottled. And then out of that room, we thought there would be a door. She remembered the tunnel when she was a little girl, and we thought there'd be a door, but there wasn't. And I looked at that wall. Any way you go, it was just a stone foundation wall. So we went upstairs and we're getting ready to leave, and all of a sudden her husband had come over. He's a fireman, and he said, you know, I think, come here, let's go outside a minute. So we go out in front, and you walk out the front door, and there was about a 3-foot gap between the sidewalk and the building. And when you walked out the front door, you didn't really think about it, but because you walked on a piece of concrete and went down one step and you're right on the sidewalk. But underneath that, there was an opening, and it was about 3 or 4 foot wide and about, you know, the length east and west, or actually north and south of the building. And there was a set of stairs you could walk down, little wooden stairs that weren't really not noticeable at all. It was dark, of course, when we were there, and we came in the back door. So we walked down those stairs, and there was, lo and behold, boarded up tunnel that went across the street, underneath the street to the other place. So, and figure.
Do you have that in your app?
Yeah, that place in my app, 534 Gillis, I think, is the address with pictures and everything. So go to my app, you can see that. So that's, a lot went on down there.
Some of the stories about tunnels in Kansas City are true. Yeah. There's a lot of stories about
tunnels that aren't true. But yeah, this one's true. This one is true.
And, of course, Joe Ramos?
Joe Ramo, he lived down in this area.
He lived over at, 514 Charlotte?
I think so, or 541. I have to look that back up here. 500 block of Charlotte. Anyhow, so let's go back. Let's get started here. Joe Ramo was assigned to work down in that area, and he had overheard a conversation of 3 Black Hand members talking about a recent murder of Paulina Pisano, a shopkeeper in the area, who had some enemies from the old country, from Sicily, anyhow, and she had been sent a extortion letter for $50 from the Black Hand, and she refused to pay it, and they killed her. And about, it was in December, and then in January, it was December 1910, January 1910, a neighboring shopkeeper had gotten one too, and he had not killed it or paid it, or if he did, they killed him anyhow. Anyhow, they don't know exactly why, but the shopkeeper almost right next door to her business was killed the next month. Joe Ramo knew who did it. And he was sitting on that knowledge when one night he was walking home from playing cards about 11 o'clock at night, walked by a vacant lot with a low stone wall in it, and there was 2 assassins waiting behind that stone wall, and they took 2 shotguns and popped him 4 times with pellets. He was hit, I think I read 18 times with these pellets, killed him dead right there on the scene. At that point, that's the Italian ghetto, and nobody comes out. They talk about today how snitches get stitches, and in the black neighborhoods, and how nobody will tell on criminals because they don't believe the police can trust them or the police can protect them. Well, it was even worse back then with the Italian community. They were an insulated community, and they didn't
call the cops, probably.
They did not call the cops. They felt safer with the black hand, I think, which, you know, that's kind of why the mafia started back in Sicily. They protected the small landowners, the tradesmen, the businessmen, the laborers. They really tried to protect them from the big landlords that would come down from upper part of Italy, or maybe they were the. They actually started before that when they had conquerors coming in from Persia, from up from Africa. The Moors at one time occupied Sicily, and so they developed a secret organization called the Mafia, or Brogata, or La Cosa Nostra in modern times, or Black Hand during these times,
or Camorra.
Camorra was from Naples. Camorra was from
was
more northern. Naples is not that far north, but it's over on what we would call the mainland. So there's two different crimes, criminal organizations in the United States at that point in time. Like, I believe Al Capone is not from Sicily. I believe he is from Naples, but he was, you know, the Chicago outfit is a different sort of a cat than the Kansas City mob or even the Cleveland mob. They have always been kind of, they called themselves the outfit, and they've always been this kind of loose-knit organization with Italians in charge, but they had a lot of, like, Frank the German Suisse, Murray the Camel Humphreys. They had a lot of non-Italians involved with them.
Ken
up
Ito.
There in Chicago. Ken Ito.
See what happened to them when they let those Peckerwoods get involved.
Really? So there's a lot of speculation about who did this at this point in time. They've made this arrest of these four guys who were the suspects in the Paulina Pisano murder. Probably those were probably the real suspects.
They were Lorenzo Messina, Nick D. Hernando, Sam Genuso, and Joe Denuncio.
Good job with that pronunciation, Aaron.
But yet the paper identified them as Syrians.
Yeah, I think the misprint.
Sicilians.
Yeah, misprint. Got to be Sicilians. Over the next several days, like I said, speculation abounded. Some Italian residents speculated that these were bad Italians in the United States trying to raise money to be sent back to Italy to pay for the defense of a member of a Camorra mafia outfit who were standing trial at that point in time. When a reporter asked him, well, what do you think this had to do with the death of Joe Ramo? And several residents said that Ramo must have possessed knowledge about this attempt to raise money to be sent back. And the way they'd raise money would be, of course, extort money from other Italian shopkeepers. So Joe Ramo must have possessed that knowledge. And since he was a man who treated everybody alike, he would do his duty to stop them from using criminal methods to obtain this money. Now, they also speculated that this kind of a spectacular killing of a man like Joe Ramo, whoever killed him knew that everybody would know about this. You kill a policeman, everybody knows. It scares everybody. It's like, oh, God, if they'll kill a policeman, they'll kill me. They'll kill anybody. So they knew that killing of a policeman would strike terror into the hearts of the gang's future victims, which would make their work a lot easier, which that reeks of Sicilians and black handers. That was their thing, the public murders and public kind of threats and letting people know, yeah, we are the black hand and we're bad. And it scares everybody and it makes their work a whole lot easier. I think the probably from that note written Sicilian, because Sicilians were the ones that belonged to Black Hands, and the Neapolitans are the ones that belonged to Camorra. I think we can lay this right to the feet of the Black Hand at the time.
Well, they even talked about, in the previous episode when we started talking about Joe Ramo, that the night of the murder was awfully quiet in the neighborhood as he walked home.
It's like everybody knew something was going to go down, so they just laid low.
Closed their windows and doors.
Just like in the old country. Now, during the investigation, there was a prominent Italian businessman agreed to provide some information on the Black Hand if he would remain anonymous, of course. Some things never change.
How can you trust the police, though?
You couldn't, actually. You wouldn't dare trust the police at this point in time in Kansas City. He said that until a couple of years ago, this is 1911, until about 1908, 1909, there was no La Mano Nera, or no Black Hand. But since that time, several businessmen have received extortion letters from the Black Hand, signed with a dripping blood dripping from a dagger and a cross. He said that most people feel safer, just what we were talking about, most people feel safer paying the protection money rather than going to the police. And this is how the Black Hand members obtained power over the community. He then told a story about a friend who received an extortion letter, and he tried to borrow some money from a moneylender. Now, these newly arrived Italian immigrants can't go to the primarily English and German-run bank, so he went to another local Italian businessman that had some money to lend, and he wanted to borrow the money to just go ahead and pay the protection. Now, the moneylender said, you know, here's what you do. He was hip to the game. Take this to your brother-in-law. Your brother-in-law runs a saloon, and he's a tough guy. He says, take this letter to the brother-in-law and let him deal with it. Brother-in-law then takes the letter, and he starts showing it around his bar to his customers. And he starts making announcements that whoever sent this letter to his family member made a mistake, and that would be the end of it. And that was the end of it. That's, you know, that's one thing. You get somebody like that to help you, another tough guy to help you. There was another friend of this businessman who was doing some talking, went to the police because he got a letter demanding $3,000 or his children would be kidnapped. So he tells the police, he said, here's what I'm going to do. And if you remember the last assignment that Joe conducted, he and another, an Irish policeman, were assigned to watch a phony bag of money in a similar kind of extortion effort, and nobody showed up, and he went on home. Then he was killed the next night. So in this situation, this guy, he gets this extortion demand letter, takes it to the police. He tells the police that he's supposed to put the money out, parcel out with some money in it, out down the street from his house. He was led to believe by the police that they'd watch the money and they'd arrest the suspects when they came. But he could watch himself from his window, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, he saw two men walking up the street, and they were acting like they were sweeping the street, but he described them as two guys that were just acting like they were sweeping the street. They didn't even know how to sweep a street. As they got close, he even recognized them, and they were Sicilians from his own neighborhood. And they grabbed the money and took off, and the police never put in any appearance at all. So that's the faith you could have in the police at the time.
But he lived to tell about it.
He's paid the money, lived to tell about it.
He saw what happened to Paulina Pisano.
Right. Well, now you got Joe Ramo on the scene, and they have just hired this guy named Luis Olivero. So maybe things are starting to turn around. But again, there's this period of time when things aren't going to turn around, and they've got to just fend for themselves. The police are not much help. As the police investigated Joe's death, somebody, they had an informant that said there were only 6 men responsible for the outrage of killing Joe Ramo and all the other Black Hand crimes. But nobody revealed those names. One of these informants was even quoted as saying if Joe Ramo had been allowed to live and given some proper backing, he would have cleaned up this gang single-handedly. He was ambitious. He could have just driven him out of town, this guy thought, but Joe didn't just drive them out of town. He was trying to gather enough information to convict them of this crime of killing Paulina Pisano and the other crimes they're involved with. April 3rd, investigations heating up a little bit, and the police have decided they're going to take some kind of strong action. Chief of police, a man named Wentworth Griffin, his chief of detectives directed 23 detectives and 17 patrolmen in plain clothes and 15 uniformed policemen to the area all around Joe Ramo's murder there at 5th and Charlotte. They conducted a systematic door-to-door search of all the houses and apartments for three blocks around. And what they were doing, Aaron, they were going in and knocking on doors and just pushing their way on in and searching. And if they'd find any guns, then they'd take the people in the guns and send them down to headquarters. People were aroused by this, of course. It was like being invaded by an army. And this drew thousands of citizens from the surrounding neighborhoods to observe this, basically an invasion by occupying army.
You couldn't really get that. Would be racial profiling today.
Yeah, you couldn't do that
one,
today.
Let alone the fact that they just, without a warrant, would show up and go in your house.
There are so many things wrong with this, but you know that it was a different time. That's all they knew how to do. They arrested 60 men of a Sicilian extraction. So they arrested six Sicilians only. Recovered 29 shotguns, revolvers, rifles, a stiletto, a cane sword, and a whole lot of shotgun cartridges filled with the same kind of buckshot that killed Officer Ramo. These shotgun shells they were using, now most shotgun gunners at the time would only had birdshot, what we call birdshot, because you kill quail, you kill ducks, you kill geese with a shotgun. It's a God, I can't think of the. If you get down to the buckshot, it's called a number four buck, and it's got about 12 32 caliber lead pellets in it, whereas the birdshot has, you know, hundreds of tiny little BBs in it. And if you get hit by birdshot, if you are a little bit off and away from the person, you know, say 10 or 15 yards, and you've got a coat on, or it just hits you, in your coat. And then your body is probably going to barely even penetrate your skin. But that buckshot, they've got extra powder kick to it also, and it will go right through anything, except, of course, bulletproof vest. But
they didn't have those then.
They didn't have those then anyhow. But what I'm saying
well,
is—
they had, like, steel plates they'd carry.
Right. But what I'm saying is this buckshot is designed to kill men. It's not designed to hunt quail or geese or ducks with.
Which is what you would think you would find if that's what they had the weapon for.
Right. Plus, they live in the city, so you're not going duck hunting on the Missouri River right down there. More and more people showed up. Chief Griffin grew a little bit nervous at the sight of so many spectators, so he started ordering policemen. This has been a big deal on the police department. He brought about every on-duty policeman he had down there just to mill around and be around the crowd and show a big presence. They had a downtown station on Walnut Street. They had the West Bottom station down on Mulberry. And the southern station was, if I remember right, it was out maybe as far south as 39th Street, the Woodland Street station. But really the crowd was reported as being quiet and orderly, mainly out of respect for Officer Ramo. And they were just content to bear what would be, I guess, silent witness to this violation of their civil rights and invasion of their neighborhood by almost like an occupying force. But they knew why the policemen were doing it, so they did not really take too much offense at it.
Even though probably odds are every single one of those officers Irish.
Hey, Irish, German, or English, that's for sure. There was no other Italians in there. They had a few black policemen at that point in time, but they would not have sent them down there on that. Now, during that day, they started bringing them in for questioning. They would quickly release 42 of them immediately on the arrival at police headquarters or shortly after a few questions. They continued questioning 18 subjects in the afternoon into the night. Now, here's an interesting little tidbit I found out. I was reading this report on this, and it says Lieutenant Edward A. Parker was in charge of the Bertillon room, and he photographed all the firearms they brought in. So I thought, well, what's a Bertillon room? I've never heard of a Bertillon room. Sounds like some kind of French thing, doesn't it, Aaron?
Maybe it's named after an officer.
Like a cotillion room or something. You have a cotillion in the Bertillon room. I don't know. Anyhow, so I researched that, you know, thanks to our good friend, Mr. Google. And I learned that in the early 1800s, there was a French criminologist named Alphonse Bertillon. and he wanted to improve on the accuracy of criminal identification. Now, this is before the fingerprint science was real new at the time. And so he developed what became known as the Bertillon system, which was a way to take, it was an improvement over just a mugshot and some basic physical measurements, and it was prior to fingerprinting. And what they did is they measured certain bony parts of your body, your skull, your foot, your trunk, your left middle finger, your ears. And these measurements were kept on what was called Bertillon cards that were about 6 by 5.5 inches. And these cards also contained the front and profile photos of the criminal. That's when the mugshot first started. And the Bertillon measurements. So if you got somebody in that looked like the photo, then you would also then start measuring their head and their ears and their middle finger and see if it measured, matched up with the measurements on the Bertillon cards. So I would say the Bertillon room was where they had a camera anyhow, and they just brought the firearms in there and photographed them. What do you think?
Well, they probably had a camera in there, but I'm thinking the Bertillon room was where they had the list of all those index cards that you were so famous for pulling when you became a police officer in 1971.
Well, we were still using 3x5 or whereas 4x5.
Yeah, you were still using the
index
the
cards.
6x5.5-inch Bertillon card, really.
And they still were when Troy Cole was running the Berdella investigation, too.
And when you'd pick a card out, there'd be a photo on it, right, with some name and some information, right?
We didn't have photos on them. What we had files, and actually for intelligence purposes, I was thinking about for leads, but for intelligence purposes, it would have a index listing. It would have C Duarte file, and then have a date on it. So then you would go to the Duarte file, and everything in there was by chronological order, and you'd go to the find the report on the person. So that would be Aaron Gunnerk.
Based on the chronology of...
Right. Say it'd be, I want to see about Aaron Gunnerk. Or maybe it'd be, see a license plate number. So you'd have the license plate number. We had license numbers in there too. So you'd go in chronological order and you'd find Aaron Gunnerk. You would find that license plate number and then you pull the card. And it would say 12-6-76, see Jimmy Duarte file. Or see firearms file. Or see Savella file. Or see Tuffy DeLuna file, or see the Virginian file.
But these are literally handwritten cards that cross-reference other handwritten cards and notes and folders and files. Is that was the system?
Yeah. Well, we had typewritten notes
and
typewritten reports by then.
Yeah, before the Alfonso Bertillon, they did. I don't know what they did.
Yeah, I don't know. Probably in the 1900s. I don't know what, 1890s, I don't know what they did. They probably didn't care that much. They just went by the seat of their pants.
Yeah, I mean, here's the French, he's a criminologist, so he's studying crime. Oh, he's French, and he's like, well, if we just had a card with some information on it.
Yeah.
It's a horrible French accent. But
that is.
Like, before that, they're like, this guy's a genius.
Well, he was at the time as a way to identify people. You know, as cities got bigger and bigger, and, you know, people were, you were dealing with a lot of strangers, you know, at one time. Yeah. Everything was like a small town.
It was.
So.
I've never been, I have been stopped by the police, but never have they measured my left middle finger.
Well,
or my right one.
I bet
it. And I've never extended it to them for measurement.
You might got it broken off.
I know. They take a sample. Well, so they keep all of this stuff. They photograph the firearms. They let 42 out of 60 guys go. 18 other men, they sit there and they question them through the night. And what do they find out? Anything?
Not a whole lot. But it's what they call sweat them. That's what you call sweating them. They continue to question them and maybe whack them around a little bit back in those days. Now, Chief Griffin released a statement that said he knew the suspects lived within a few blocks of where Officer Ramo was killed. He said he had information, and he has known for quite some time that the Italian criminals in Kansas City have meeting places down in Little Italy, and they're known to store large quantities of guns and ammo. And one of the places that they raided that day was a pool hall and a bar located at 602 East 5th Street. Now, before you go down that path, Aaron, that there's nothing there at 602 East 5th.
That doesn't mean it couldn't be in your app, the Kansas City Mob Tour. I mean,
it's about 2 blocks from the assassination site. Now, in the front area of the pool hall, the police find your normal pool tables, and then there's a counter that separates the front room with a back room, and in the back room, there's two tables for card games. And near one of these card tables, there was a hidden trap door that went down into the cellar. And in the cellar, they found some beer, 8 revolvers, 12 double-barrel shotguns, and several rifles. And they also found many of those shotgun cartridges loaded with buckshot. Know that up above it, there's a brand new family that just moved here from Sicily named Barbosi, and that day they fled the city. Chief Griffin and Detective Inspector Boyle and Captain Flahive were questioning the prisoners as they were brought in, and then later that evening, Captain J.J. Ennis, who was the night chief of police, and Sergeant S.W. Zickfuss, sounds like a German name to me, continued the interrogation of the suspects taken to police headquarters. They take the prisoners out of the lockup. We still do that today. You got them in a lockup, and you take them out one by one, and you sweat them, or you question them intensely. And Sergeant Zickfuss, he noticed that the jailers were putting the prisoners who had already been sweated or already been questioned back into the same cells with the prisoners who are waiting to be questioned. Well, you always keep people separated so they don't know what's been asked and who said what. And of course, this allowed the new prisoners to learn the direction and the types of questions and the direction of the questioning before they were even taken in. So they were hip and they were ready to with some answers. So Sergeant Zickfuss ordered the prisoners be separated into different cells. One cell for the people that had already been sweated, and then one and cells for the people who had not been sweated.
But this, of course, after they'd already kind of mingled them all together.
Right. I wonder if they still use that. We used to use that when I was a young policeman. They're going to sweat him. Take somebody in and sweat him. I wonder if they still use that term. Probably not.
I don't know. I always heard that, and I thought they turned the heat up.
Yeah, you turn the heat
nothing
up.
Nothing worse
right.
than sitting in a room and you're hot.
Sometimes we call that we're going to tune them up. You ever heard that one?
No, I hadn't heard that one.
Well, you don't need to know any more about tuning them up. I bet a lot of our listeners out there know what get somebody to tune them up it means. Some of the prominent Italians were questioned by the Kansas City Star. Some prominent Italians were questioned by the Kansas City Star reporters later that day or the next day. And they were shown a list of the locations that were raided, like that pool hall we just talked about. And several of them said, anonymously, of course, if they ever get anybody, they will get them there. But they wouldn't say anymore. There's a good friend of Joe Ramo who, again, wouldn't give his name, but he commented that Joe was a cop who knew Little Italy well. And he knew those places himself, and Joe knew them, and he knows that those people are not friendly to Joe. They were hangouts for bad men. Now, they didn't deport anybody, but here's what happened. A rumor got started that the city of Kansas City was going to pass what's known as a law of subsistence. Now, I've not ever exactly heard of this, but it's real close to our vagrancy laws that we had all the way up until probably the 80s. This was a law that had been used extensively in Italy, and it gave the police the right to arrest and hold any man who could not satisfactorily give an explanation of how he was able to live or where he worked or how he made his money. So a lot of people were, they were really scared, and they did not want to have anything to do with the police, stayed away from them. The city did, at least on the surface, promise a very strict enforcement of vagrancy laws in the Italian district in the community.
Unfortunately, I don't think vagrancy or subsistence was really the issue that killed Joe Ramo.
No, it wasn't.
I mean, yeah, maybe they were loitering at the time, but they certainly were loitering with an intent.
I guess I can understand the reasoning behind it, though. It was like these guys are criminals and they don't have regular jobs.
Yeah.
So go find the people who don't have the regular jobs, and they must be the right people, and get rid of them.
Well, you've been on a patrol before, sitting in a car down the street from a social club, haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
Back in the day, working the intelligence unit. Did any of those guys necessarily have a job?
Oh, some of them did, some of them didn't. A lot of them had businesses. They'd have some kind of business.
Kind of that, business.
Right.
Gave them a cover.
Right.
Maybe they were just a dishwasher like Joe Augusto.
Yeah, really. I'm just a dishwasher here. I'm not mafia. Yeah, so, I mean, they'd have some kind of business or investments or something, or have a connection to an amusement company that they'd say they were a route salesman for. They'd have some kind of cover job. Business and religious leaders of the day, and particularly the religious leaders, were asked about this. Reverend Henry Satorio and Reverend Louis Lorenzana. They were both from the Italian Evangelical Church, which would be a Protestant, Italian Protestant church. I didn't really know there was such a thing, but I guess there is. I know there's a lot of Mexicans that are Jehovah's Witnesses, or there's a evangelical kind of a church, a Protestant church that a lot of Hispanics go to. I've seen them around the city. But they admitted that the Kansas City Italian colony, they called it the Italian colony at the time, needed cleaning up, and it held men worse. Our particular Italian colony, they believed, held men worse than in any other city. And what I find interesting is the Catholic priest who presided at Joe's funeral, Father Del Becci, he was asking, he said, well, you know, since the murder, I've not really gotten out into the community and been able to learn anything that was going on. He was not going to commit himself on the Black Hand people. He had to go back down into that Holy Rosary church every day and go to work.
Well, just because he was a priest and he was at the church doesn't mean that he potentially wouldn't be a victim of Black Hand extortion.
Sure, he was not protected at all.
I mean, he had the Lord's protection, but I don't know what that's going to do for him if they show up.
Well, he didn't want to incur their wrath. Their wrath, good word.
Don't quote me on that.
Better than their other word. Don't quote me on that. Hey, I don't know really what's going on.
Don't bug me. Go after Joe Ramos' son.
And really. By April 5th, 1911, all the Italians that were rounded up in this April 3rd raid were released, except three men, and they focused most on these guys as suspects. There were two brothers, Andrea and Samuel Trapani, and Charles Musso. They were taken into the chief of police office, Wentworth Griffin's office, and the Jackson County prosecutor, Mr. S.S. Grenlock, good German name, came in and questioned him for 3 hours. But, you know, they barely spoke English, and they just grunted out yes or no. And they indicated they were at home in bed asleep at the time of the Ramo murder. Now, these men, they focused on them because the Trapani brothers owned and operated this pool hall at 603 East 5th, where all those guns were found, and the pool hall that many of the prominent people down in Little Italy said was a place where what they called bad men hung out. Now, the other guy, Charlie Musso, he owned what was called the Young Italians Club, a pool hall at 403 Locust, and the police found quite a few guns and ammo there. So I think they had the right people, but, you know.
The club that Joe Ramo was at, that when he overheard the conversation between the Black Handers, I'm trying to look that one up.
Yeah, I don't know. I never could find. They just said it was a saloon of ill repute.
They didn't actually give a name or an address.
I did not find the name or the address of that.
403 Locust is another probably location that's no longer a pool hall.
No, it's not.
But it would be a great location to add to the app.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. What is it, 403 Locust?
Guns and Ammo.
Guns and Ammo? Is there a gun store down there?
I mean, here we're talking about, this is really, I mean, he was murdered. I'm looking back on the notes. And it was on March 28th.
Right.
Right? 1911.
Right.
In the 11:15 p.m., they thought, in the evening. So by April 5th, they'd pretty much rounded up everybody.
Yeah. April 3rd, they did the big raid. And by April 5th, they were down to the last three suspects, and they couldn't get them. They needed a confession. They had no other witnesses. They had no evidence, and these guys.
Everybody,
you know,
acted like they didn't understand the questions, and they were sleepy.
Yeah.
I was home in bed. What happened
asleep
to sweating them? What happened to those four guys whose names we actually mentioned?
Yeah, really? Well, I don't know.
And what happened to the two guys and the sister who left immediately after?
Yeah, they might have known something.
The Black Handers, they would snuff out those people, too.
In a second. They were certainly expendable or disposable. Now, these last three guys that owned these pool halls, they were recently arrived from Sicily sometime in the last 3 years. And if you remember, one of those businessmen said, you know, up until about 3 years ago, we had no black ant problem. And these guys got here about 3 years ago. During their 3 years in Kansas City, the chief of police himself would say to the newspapers that they became known as the terrors of Little Italy. So I think they probably had the three guys that probably ordered it, and those other four guys that we mentioned before, probably at least a couple of them are the ones that carried it out. In the aftermath of all these raids, all the pool halls and saloons and restaurants were vacant every night. Everybody just stayed out. More cops were posted on the street as usual. Everybody was staying inside. Jenny Ramo and her children were still, they were afraid to stay at home, and they stayed with relatives for a while. Then she went into police headquarters to see Chief Wentworth and asked for police protection when she returned home, and he kind of, he gave her a little bit, but not really very much. Kansas City Star, about a month later, 30 days later after all this, it still fired up down there. The Kansas City Star did an interview of a restaurant owner named Mike Pecoraro. He had, I never did find the name of it or the location, but he said what he had was a spaghetti joint. He said that people are still afraid to come down to the spaghetti joints, and his in particular, he said the tables are, he's quoted as saying, the tables are empty, gathering dusk, and he hadn't played his automatic piano for weeks. I guess this back when they had player pianos, huh? He went, you know, and they quoted him as saying, nobody's ever been shot or stabbed except out in the street one time in front of the joint when one man was shot, but not inside. I always keep the bad men away. And then he says, there's no black hand anyhow. I wish I could do an Italian accent here. If there is, they never bother Americans, but these Americans are funny people. They're afraid of the black hand, and they don't come here anymore. They won't respect me. I can't understand it. Every night they used to lose their diamonds and rings and stuff like that here, and the next day the phone starts ringing. They'd say, Mike, I lost my ring down there last night. Have you seen it? Then I answer, it's here. I keep it on my sideboard. Then they say, Mike, you're a jewel. Probably I find 100 rings here. I give them all back. And now they don't come to my place because everybody's talking about the black hand. Bah, there's no danger. Americans are so funny when they get scared. Others, I've talked about that before. I once interviewed an old Italian guy who's kind of a mob associate, and he was actually almost on his deathbed. And that's what he called people who weren't Italian. He said the Americans. He said that when he was a kid, they always called everybody that wasn't Italian an American. July the 19th, 1911, Ms. Ramos, of course, is still drawing Joe's full salary. She's got four more months on that. She has almost a mental breakdown. She appears at police headquarters begging for police protection. She had been threatened by somebody, and the police said they expected to make arrests, but I could find no reports of any arrest made on that.
No news reports.
No news reports, and there's no police reports, of course, from that time. There was a grand jury investigation that returned one indictment. A lot of those people who they'd brought in and sweated then were given grand jury subpoenas, and they put them in front of a grand jury. They issued one indictment, and that was for perjury, and this guy made what was called an inconsistent statement between what he said to the grand jury under oath and what he had said to the police. The next information I could ever find, it kind of like dies on out, except I know Luis Olivero was hired at the time, and he starts working a little lately. But in October of 1911, that's about, what, 6 months later, young Frank Ramo was brought before the truancy judge and threatened with reform school at the McCune Farm for Boys. Now, we still have the McCune, they call it the McCune Home for Boys, but back then it was the McCune Farm for Boys. And they quote him in the paper as reassuring the judge that this will never happen again if you'll just release me back to my mother. And Frank Ramo, his oldest son, will go on and start and operate a successful, I believe it was a printing business. He'll have four children, two boys and two girls, and one of them, Thomas Ramo, will become a famous athlete at the Jesuit Rockhurst School for Boys. And Thomas, I even traced down all of his relatives. He has several children. All of his sons attended Rockhurst. I sent out an email. Actually, I had a mutual friend who knows Mike Ramo really well, and we sent out a message to him to get him to call me or to email me, and I never have heard back from him, so maybe they don't want to talk about their great-grandpa, who was actually an Italian hero.
But did you ever find any information about Mrs. Ramo? What happened to her?
You know, I couldn't. I couldn't. She died after that, but she lived for quite a while, I believe, but I don't really know. She just died of natural causes, and the other kids, I couldn't find out hardly anything. Mainly, I found out about this Thomas Ramo being Frank's kid because he was such a famous athlete, and they were printing all kinds of articles about him in the Star over the years. And that's a high school athlete. They used to pay a lot more attention to high school athletics than they do now. So that ends the story of the hiring, the career, and the killing of Giuseppe or Joseph Ramo, a nice young Italian boy, came over here from Naples, Italy, and learned English, killed in the line of duty because he knew too much about the Black Hand and the subsequent investigation. There's a lot of parallels between Joe and Joe Petrosino. It's just that Joe Petrosino had the backing of the New York City Police Department, and Joe Ramo had no backing of the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department whatsoever. He was pretty much out there on his own.
They basically hired him. He was like a
token.
Yeah, it's a token officer, if you will. And then they sent him out to the neighborhood that he was from.
And living in, and to handle the Italian crime. He could speak the language. I mean, there was a huge language problem. So he could speak the language. He would have been effective, and he probably was effective, and they were probably glad to see him down there.
It's probably part of why he ended up being killed.
He was a little too effective. He'd been better off if he'd have taken some money. I'm sure that he was offered money. That's why he was killed. When he refused the money, they knew that they had to do him, which is pretty much how those guys operate. If they don't have you under their control, you're expendable. And
well, it's a threat to them. They're essentially operating outside the law, and here comes this guy who's a Italian and knows this culture, knows the language, knows the people. The people in the community know him, and he represents law enforcement.
Right, and the thing about that is this was a secret society of criminals, the Black Hand, and they depended, and the Mafia has long depended on staying below the radar, not drawing the attention of law enforcement, and they wanted to stay below the radar, so the Irish and German policemen, nobody was going to share anything with them. A lot of them were corrupt themselves anyhow, but they couldn't speak the language, so it was easy to hide, you know, the existence of their organization from the Irish and English and German policemen. Not so easy to hide it from another Italian policeman. He had too many contacts in the neighborhood.
Here we go. I was doing a search, and on findagrave.com, there is a Joseph Ramo with a photograph of him in his uniform and the actual headstone at the cemetery where he's at, which is St. Mary's.
22nd in Cleveland, yeah.
Here, and buried March 30th, 1911.
Right around the corner from Nick Savella. And a whole lot of other mob guys.
Genevieve DeFeo, who was born in 1882, died in 1969.
Okay, she lived to be quite old.
Let's see how that...
I'm glad you looked that up.
They had a number of children here as well.
Right.
I will go back to those.
I've said that already. They had four kids. And, yeah. And the one I could trace, the only direct descendant I could trace down to the day was Thomas Frank, the oldest Frank, and then Thomas. And I can't remember that young guy's name. That I was trying. I think Mike, maybe.
Hold on, I'll go back. But the wife... Genevieve?
Mm-hmm. Jenny. Everybody called her Jenny.
Jenny DeFeo also says buried at Mount St. Mary's Cemetery here in Kansas City.
Yeah, and she buried there with Joe?
So.
I imagine so.
Yeah, I'm looking here because it looks like it's the same headstone. Doesn't really give any information about her life. But, if you wanted to narrow down and did any searching on it, like in your newspaper stuff, definitely you're looking at when she died, which had been 1969.
All right. I think we've done that story then. If you have a friend or a relative, a loved one that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say, folks need to buy the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon as a streaming purchase, or you can rent it. And you need to get the Kansas City Mob Tour app for $1.99. You can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And then you need to get the book that Gary just finished writing and released, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
Hear it from the mouth of the men that did it at ganglandwire.com.
Say goodnight, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Automatic.
On the advice of my lawyer, I respectfully refuse to answer that question.
You know, what's kind of interesting and maybe a little bit of a parallel today with all the immigration stuff going on and deportation and a lot of rumors going around the Hispanic community. I was just talking to a client of mine who's here legally, but his wife was not for a long time. Matter of fact, that's when I first met him. She had to go back to Guatemala and do some paperwork, and then she was able to come back and have a green card. They're really afraid of what's going on if you're illegal and afraid of deportation and other problems with the police. Most people, you know, Aaron, they just want to work.
Yeah.
They just came up here to work. Most of them I've ever met, got to know very well, they want to work and make enough money to go back home and buy a house so they don't have to pay rent and they own their own home and then have some kind of subsistence job. My friend that I talked to today said, you know, we'd like to go back, but the corruption's so bad that you just can't. It's too unsure of a life. There's such a lack of security, and he's from Guatemala, so it's even worse down there in Guatemala.
Well, I would think, you know, with the current situation, that a lot of folks wouldn't be reporting any crimes to the police
right.
if they're illegal.
Right.
I mean, like the crime's illegal. I mean, if they're not legal residents, they're not going to call the cops because they may be detained and deported.
Right, which makes them more susceptible to extortion and other crime from
their own community.
From their own community.
And here we're talking, you know, 1911.
Right.
And here the law enforcement, they just kind of come in and sweep through the neighborhood in a raid. You know, what was kind of the repercussion of that?